Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
To have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Said, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Alan Hunter with us, the author of The Path of Synchronicity. Align yourself with your life's flow. And as a matter of fact, I think those words in and of themselves say a tremendous amount. Alan was born and educated in England, living in Surrey and Oxfordshire before moving to Boston and becoming a naturalized American citizen. And growing up, he lived in Belgium, Italy, Sardinia, and Madagascar, as well as England. And he received his doctorate at Oxford University in literature with a focus on Joseph Conrad. Now, he's the author of 10 books, including two about the therapeutic uses of writing. And the books are tremendous. And I want to make sure we get enough time with Alan. So, Alan, hi. Welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here, Alan. You know, when we talk about synchronicity, I know you've traveled the globe. And with all of your searching and looking and researching, where was it that you realized when the light bulb went on that synchronicity was really the bridge of coming together?
Oh, well, synchronicity is one of those wonderful things that keeps nudging you until you pay full attention to it. And so it's one of those things where when you look back on it, as I think Schopenhauer actually said, when you look back on your life and you begin to think about how you got to where you are now, you begin to see how many strange coincidences there are and there have been that have brought each individual to where he or she is. And for me, I think actually the moments when this happened, I can't remember the precise moment, but I can remember when I was thinking about it, was when I was wandering around collecting stories just for my own interest on people who had been married for a long period of time and been happily married. And I asked them, so how did you know? And in every case, and I kept, you know, asking people, in every case they were able to say, well, you know, I did this and I met this person and I just knew. And I thought, gosh, that's rather unusual. But what it was telling me over and over again, because I had a similar experience in my own life, what it was telling me is that if we're open to what the world is sending us, rather than closed and determined only to take what we think we expect, if we're open, sometimes these moments of knowing hit us, and that's a type of synchronicity, when you know this is where I'm supposed to be.
That aha moment.
What's supposed to happen.
Yeah, Alan, it's that aha moment. I think the path of synchronicity, align yourself with your life's flow. The greatest analogy that I've ever heard regarding that, and when I read the tagline, it hit. It was if you were body surfing down a river and there was a big stone in the middle of the river. Now, if you resist the current, you're going to insert yourself into the stone. But if you just relax and, quote, go with the flow, you're going to go around the stone. And I think
precisely.
That's really it. It's called stop resisting and allow yourself to accept the challenges that are put in front of you.
What what a beautiful example that is, because that's exactly what happens. If you fight the flow, you'll almost certainly wind up against the rock because the current wants to go around the rock. And so many people fight the flow that is in their lives for whatever reasons, usually reasons that have to do with thinking that things ought to be otherwise. And that makes us miserable, and it invites us out of the place of synchronicity. So that's a wonderful example, Michael.
No, by the way, Ellen, when we talk about listening to others, and I think that's critically important, because if we listen to others, it's their perfection, their ideas, their synchronicity, quote unquote, that you're trying to match up to, and it's never going to happen. I think that's the major mistake that most people make. I can't live your life through my existence, because no matter what I do, I'm going to be the second best Alan.
That's exactly it, yes. And, you know, unfortunately, so much of this loving advice, which is wrong advice, comes from people that we respect. It comes from parents who want us to be something, siblings who want us to be something else, bosses, society, what we see on the TV. But whilst we're doing that, we are, as you say, becoming second-rate yes. Our versions of ourselves. And what we have to be, I think, is true to what we feel to be our truth and where we're being taken. And if we listen to that, it will take us where we need to go, which might not be the same place as where we imagined we would be at age, you know, 10, 15, well, sure. or 20, but it will be the place we need to be. And that's the importance of synchronicity.
And I think it's critical also, and an example happened to me years ago. I was doing a workshop, and I jumped on a chair, and I looked at the audience, and I said, describe me. And I got everything from your wonderful, loving, nurturing individual to your self-centered, egotistical son of a yada, yada, yada. And they said, who are you talking about? They said, you. And I said, whoa. They were projecting. And I think that's the major problem. If somebody finds a fault with you, they want you to do something better. They're not talking about you. They're talking about them. And we never make that distinction, and we get stuck.
We get stuck, exactly. That's a marvelous example. I could perhaps add one to that, and that is John Steinbeck, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist. He knew he had to be a writer, and as a young writer, he thought, well, what do I do that'll make me famous? And he looked at the book market, and he decided that historical fiction set in the 17th century was going to make him famous. So he wrote these four huge books, he tells us in his memoirs, and nobody wanted them. And then he said, oh, the heck with this, he said. I'm going to write about what's right in front of me. And what was right in front of him were the poor people of California. And once he started writing those stories, what was in front of him, what he cared about, what he saw every day, what really moved him, that's when his writing career took off in a big way. And I think the lesson there is, for all of us, don't try to be what you think someone else thinks you should be. Do what is authentically you.
And one of the problems that we have with that, and I can see this in so many people, and it's taken a lot of years to learn this, obviously. I wasn't born with it, but it's taken enough time to watch, go through my own stuff and watch other people, is that when it comes down to it, when people are frightened to death of making a decision because of what they think somebody else is going to think. What I finally learned over all the years was it's all a learned response. So if you can learn something, Alan, you can unlearn it, and you can relearn a different alternative to it. And I think that's really where it is. You talk about the shadow. What is the shadow?
Well, the shadow is actually exactly what we're talking about here, and that is, as we go through life, you know, as we grow up, as we're socialized, we're told to quash all those feelings that are not acceptable. So anger, destructiveness, rage. If you're a man, you're told to be more manly and be less interested in perhaps the more feminine side of oneself. And by crushing that down in order to fit in, we're doing exactly what you describe. But unfortunately, we're cutting ourselves off from about 50% of our resources, and we're using a huge amount of energy to do that, because rage is a bad thing, of course. It can get out of hand, but it's also a vital part of ourselves, and we have to use it. And I mean that sincerely, because if you think of Martin Luther King, you know, nonviolence, that was the tenet that he lived by. But he was questioned very closely. He said, well, what happens, that people asked him, what happens if you find yourself being opposed violently? And his response was quite simple, and that is, if you understand your own shadow, your own desire to respond to violence with violence, if you can understand that, then you don't have to get into a fight. You can use that righteous rage, perhaps, in order to make sure the other person doesn't hurt you or the other people don't hurt you further. And in that way, you use the shadow energy positively. And that's something that many of us have yet to understand, because we're so busy, as you so rightly say, trying to fit in, trying to do things, trying to be nice. And we cut ourselves off from this prodigious source of energy, the energy that really does allow us to be authentic and help the world to be a little better, even if we're not Martin Luther Kings, you know, even if we're not. I could give you another example. In my counseling practice, I sometimes come across parents who are terrified of being too strict with their children. And so they're not strict at all, because they're afraid that they will seem angry to their children. And to which I say, well, you know, sometimes you have to say no to a child for his or her own good. That's the nature of parenting. You can't be everybody's friend and be a successful parent and bring up a good child. And so by cutting themselves off from their sense of perhaps outrage, which, of course, every child is going to annoy us at some point, but by not being able to trust that they can contain that and use that shadow energy, children run out of control and do themselves no benefit at all, and that's when we have very, very dysfunctional families.
By the way, I'm listening very closely to what you say, and I think what I would do with the path of synchronicity, align yourself with your life's flow, I think I would add something to that. And I would say align yourself with your life's flow, the path to permission. And I think that's really where it is. We're frightened to death, Alan, to give ourselves permission to be a certain way, to feel a certain way, and to have a certain thing. We look for permission outside, and that's where the conflict and the challenges start, because permission comes from within. You've got to be able to give yourself permission to do whatever you want in life.
Yes, yes. I like that very much. I mean, yes, we look for permission as opposed to giving ourselves our own permission to be who we are. And certainly, if we go back to my example of parenting, you know, the best gift we can ever give to a child is to be authentically ourselves,
sure,
so that the child can learn from what we do and be authentically him or herself. That's the finest gift. But yes, you're absolutely right. It has to do with changing the permission that we often seek from the world into giving ourselves our own agency, and that's very different.
Oh, sure. We're running out of time now, but I really believe if my mom was still alive and I was sitting here the age that I am now, and I'm not a youngster, and she said, you get in here right now, I'd probably just jump up and move without thinking. But that's what parents are about. They're not your friend. They're the ones that will teach your survival, and that's really what it's about. Alan, let me ask
exactly.
you this. Website we can find you at, please.
Yes, it's www.alan.hunter.net.
Don't go to .com,
it's an Australian footballer.
Alan, can we buy the books on the website?
Yes, you can on the website. You can also get The Path of Synchronicity on Amazon.com, which is probably most people know that best. But you can buy the books on the website or go to Findhorn Press. There's a link from the website to both of these places.
Wonderful. Dr. Alan Hunter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for including me. It's been a great pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just
to... Tom Grayson with us. He is the co-author of Turbocharged, Accelerate Your Fat-Burning Metabolism, Get Lean Fast, and Leave Diet and Exercise Rules in the Dust. He and his sister have been spent 30 years now working directly with renowned scientific researchers studying health, exercise, longevity, and stress management. They're the co-authors of Turbocharged. Again, Accelerate Your Fat-Burning Metabolism, Get Lean Fast, and Leave Diet and Exercise Rules in the Dust. And let us say, Tom, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, did I pronounce your name right? I hope I did.
Well, Grissel.
Grissel, okay. Can I do the entire intro again?
No.
No. Okay. we're good. I will never. I've got it down pat now. It's Tom Grissel. Tom, that's where great. Was it that? And I have to go back 30 years. Where was it that you got interested in this? You researched it. You became part of it with the programs. What was it that caused you and your sister to get involved here?
Well. You know, I don't know exactly when it started. I was always, health and fitness were always a passion of mine, and I always, I always just was fascinated with it, and read books forever. And then my younger sister, had the same sort of desire. And, so early on, we started to collaborate. She went on to get a PhD in nutrition. And over the years, we were always reading, experimenting, trying virtually every new diet that came out. And that was kind of the beginning.
Now, by the way, when we look at this, and this is directly from your press release, because I think it's critical to lay the base. Diets and fitness programs and personal trainers and drugs and supplements and weight loss gadgets to choose from. There are so many people that are so confused today. They start a program, a regime, and then they get to a certain point and they quit and they gain all the weight back or they get out of shape and it goes on and on and on. And it seems as though everybody keeps coming back to square one and they haven't found that certain something. I've met people that have had the gastric bypasses that a year later they've gained weight and some people have actually committed suicide. So what do we do? What's that bridge to be able to get across to getting what you want and being able to deal with it once you get there?
Yeah, well, that's so true. And that's the reason why we wrote the book. Statistically right now, over 30%, Center for Disease Control says that 34% of the American population of adults is obese. And another survey said that 70% of Americans feel that they, that they need to lose weight and are on some sort of a diet. But with all of the gyms and all of those other things that you mentioned and all of the diet books and magazines, obviously there's something wrong because it's not working.
Okay, but with the research, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and that's the reason why, and we experience that ourselves. You know, in trying all these diets, we never got lean and never experienced the kind of health that you know, that all of these programs or books espoused. So that kind of went us on, you know, set us on a you know, on a mission, you know, to just figure out what works and what doesn't.
Now, really, when we're talking about losing weight, getting fit, it all falls into that category of health. And most people don't get that. They think health is taking a pill and going to the doctor's office, getting a shot, and it's over with. That's not what health is all about. So to achieve that lean look, to achieve what you want, feeling good, et cetera, what's the first step? What do you start with? Is it nutrition? Is it exercise? What is it?
Well, you know, in our book, step one, we have 8 steps in the book, Michael, and the step one is not even a step at all, but it's critical, and that is we tell people to forget everything that they've ever heard or think they know about diet and exercise, because there's so much bad information out there, and that's what we think is the problem. It's just misinformation. So the start is just to, you know, start with a clean slate. If you've tried different diets before and you've tried to lose weight and you can't keep it off, you just can't keep on doing the same thing over and over again. You know, so the first step is to realize that, you know, take a look around and see that diet and exercise, either people are not listening and not trying, or the diet and exercise information out there is just flawed.
Tom, I've been into gyms in and out my entire life. I'm a gym rat. I always have been, and I always will be till the day I'm gone. And one of the things that I've seen that people will go in, they're supposed to go to the gym, and they're using, let's say, a piece of equipment, and they are so bored while they're doing it. You can see it in their faces. They're not putting any effort out. They're getting the 10 reps in, and that's the end of it. Every once in a while, I've walked up to somebody, and I said, "You want to get the most out of that?" And they'll look at me and say, "Yeah, get mad. Your husband, your wife, or somebody that you don't like right now, take it out on them." And they start doing that, and they sweat, and it starts to work. But that doesn't mean that they're going to do it that way the next time. They've got to have something that they're excited about, something that they know is working, and it's something that's working with their entire lifestyle.
Yeah. And you know what? That's the biggest problem. People listen, traditional diet and exercise advice, weight loss advice, says that you need to eat a balanced diet based on the USDA food pyramid, which is now my plate, reduce your caloric intake, and increase your exercise. And that's the formula that everybody gives out. But it really doesn't work. Most people who actually follow it and do work out very hard and do restrict their calories end up with overwhelming senses of hunger. And the reason for that is that working out really hard while you're reducing your calories is a very unnatural thing to do. It's not something that our bodies were designed to do. And what happens during those workouts is your body can't keep up with the energy deficit. So it starts to convert some of your lean body mass, your muscles, into glucose for energy. And that's a very bad thing. And that's how your brain recognizes that, and it pushes back and makes people feel very hungry after following that program.
You know, it's amazing that all these years that if people would understand that, would realize that. And I know that the industry is a billion-dollar industry out there for weight loss and gyms and so on and so forth. But I think the real key is exactly what you said. Understand your body chemistry. Understand that what actually is going to happen, the dynamic of what occurs when somebody actually works out or goes on a diet or does anything in particular. If you begin to understand what causes it, the factors that cause it to happen, all of a sudden things start to work. If you just go in cold, you're going to trip yourself up.
Okay, and that's true. And so the second step in turbocharged, which is very important, is that everybody goes about thinking about weight loss. And when you get on a scale and you watch your weight go down, you never know what you're losing, Michael. Most people on a traditional diet will lose not only fat, but they'll lose lean body mass also. So what happens is that they shrink down. Their body composition may not change very much. They're just a smaller version of their former selves. And so they kind of they have less fat, but compared to the rest of their body, they have the same percentage of body fat. So the next thing that people have to really focus on is forget about weight loss. What they really want to lose, what everybody wants when they go to the gym, is they want to lose their excess fat. Okay, and that's a key differentiator that people have to understand, because if you go into gym to lose weight, you may very well lose weight, but not the kind of weight that you want.
By the way, when somebody goes to a gym also, if you're working your muscles are going to get larger, and if that happens, you gain weight. Now, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But if somebody's going in there to lose weight, they're not recognizing the difference between the muscle mass and the fat that's being stored.
Sure. I mean, if you go to your gym and you look around, I mean, it happens to me. I don't belong to a gym right now. I do what's in the book. But, you know, when you go to a gym, you could see people who work out very, very hard, but yet they're not lean. And they think that the harder they work out and the fitter they get, that the leaner they're going to get and the healthier they're going to get. And that's another myth. That's just not true.
Now, by the way, in following the process and the program in the book, is there exercise in it at all? Is there certain techniques that you can use to keep yourself lean?
Yes, there is. The biggest thing is that when you know, I'm not going to tell anybody that they can get lean without controlling their diet a little bit and reducing calories to a certain extent, because you can get fat eating anything, but there are what we focus on in the book is what caused, because the book Turbocharged is all about fat loss. That's what it's about. And so what we do is we look at why fat accumulates on our bodies and what the fastest way to get rid of it is. And that's the whole theme of the book, and that's what it revolves around. So yes, what we do is we tell people not to engage in strenuous exercise while they're trying to lose body fat. Once they get lean, then, you know, the sky's the limit. They can go, you know, climb Mount Everest if that's what they want. But if their goal is to get lean, they need to work with their body and not against it.
Now, by the way, the old system was the tried and true was this. You take in so many calories. Let me pick a number. You take in 100 calories a day. And you take in 100 calories and you exercise and you only burn off 20 calories. Okay, so now you've taken more in than you've burned off. You're going to either keep or maintain weight. And that's based on the caloric intake and what you do or don't burn off. And that usually was the old formula that worked for a lot of people. You burn off the excess that you've eaten and then you'll maintain, or you burn off more then and you'll lose, or you don't burn it off, you're going to gain. That's the way
you know. If you look at how many calories you burn on a Stairmaster, it's a lot easier to cut out your morning latte than it is to go and exercise, you know, for 45 minutes. Because you know, exercise is great for fitness, but it's really not very efficient when you're trying to reduce or eliminate your excess body fat.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say, and if you're going to reduce excess body fat, if you want to drop some pounds, ease up in the gym in and of itself. Now, once you've dropped the weight, if you want to go be a Schwarzenegger, then you go after it full blown, and you're fine. But it depends on what you want to do. And from what I'm hearing you say, and I completely agree with this, is most people confuse the purpose that they're in the gym for.
That's exactly right. Most people who go to the gym would always go there thinking that they go there thinking that they're going to improve their health. But the real reason they want to go there is to get rid of stubborn body fat or excess body fat. That's the reason why they go. And the formula that they're using is not efficient for doing that. It works for some people. You know, you can look around and you can see very lean people who work out a lot. But once you're lean, it's a lot easier to stay that way than to try and get there in the first place.
Oh, sure. Tom, let me ask you this. I think it's an important question. There are people who are lean. I'm lean, and I've been lean the bulk of my life. And I'm one of the reverse kind of people. If you tell me what to do to lose weight, I have to reverse it so I can gain it. But I still have a little bit of, you know, and I'm cut pretty good, but I still have a little bit of body fat. And I think most people run with that body fat and they get stuck with it. How do you get rid of that little bit of excess around the belly?
Go ahead.
Oh, that was it.
Okay. Well, you know what? There are reasons why body fat accumulates, and I guess the simplest explanation is it's more dealing with hormones. When people eat, for example, when people eat too many carbohydrates throughout the day, their blood sugar elevates. Their body releases, their pancreas releases insulin in order to reduce the level of blood sugar. And that blood sugar is converted either into a small amount of glycogen, which goes into your muscles or your liver, and all of the excess goes to body fat. So a lot of getting very lean has to do with diet. You know, 80% of being lean is absolutely diet.
Or is it diet, or let's transition to another word. Is it diet, or Tom, is it nutrition?
Well, I look at it the same, because what happens is I think that people can consume a calorie is not a calorie. I guess maybe that's where you're going, Michael. A calorie is not a calorie. You can eat 20 calories of potato chips, or you can eat 20 calories let's put it this way: you can eat 500 calories of potato chips, and you can eat 100 calories of a proper food that does have nutrients in it and nutrition, and your body is going to react the same. A lot of the junk food and refined foods that people eat these days are just not satisfying their body from a nutritional standpoint. So their body instinctually craves more food, trying to make up for that deficit.
Okay, so effectively, we're really dealing with survival. And that's when I say survival, your body goes into that survival mode because it feels that it needs something, quote unquote. So it's going to push you into eating more than you should eat the wrong foods. And when once it gets that fat storage, it feels that it's safe again, and then it lets it go. And I think that's about as simple as it gets without talking about the dynamic of chemicals that occur to cause these things or not. By the way, I think what you've done is really great. Turbocharge. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, and also buy the book?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do.
We don't sell the book on the website, but there's a lot of good information there. The website is turbocharged.us.com, and the book is available on Amazon either as a regular book or as Kindle. And bookstores are starting to order it right now. So, you know, if it's not in your local bookstore and that's what you and that's the way you like to buy books, then just go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you.
Wonderful. Hey, Tom, thank you so much for joining us. We're just about out of time, and I appreciate the time you spent.
Thank you so much, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only... That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enjoy.
of time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. James Timothy White with us, and he's the author of Asset Protection, What If? Oh, do I sound like I'm getting some feedback here, Seth? What are we doing here? Anyway, here we go. James Timothy White, 26. He's an entrepreneur, the author, and the chairman of President and CEO of Eurotax Friends, Inc. It's an international merger and acquisitions firm with its head office located in the British Virgin Islands, and chairman, president, and CEO of Eurotax Global Savings and Trust. And let us say, James, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Where are you in the Virgin Islands, or are you there now?
I'm not there right now. I'm located in Tortola, the BVIs. It's just beautiful there. But right now I'm currently in Texas working on a couple of our construction projects we have going along the coastline right now.
Yeah, by the way, I spent a year in the West Indies on cruise ships in the very early 80s, 81, 82, and it's absolutely gorgeous. What a wonderful place to be. I really believe if somebody wants to know what paradise is like, get down to the Virgin Islands and spend a little time.
Oh, it's just amazing. Yeah, the only problem is you got between, you know, trying to get from Florida to the BVIs, sometimes it's about a 20 and 25-hour flight, so it just... It deters a lot of tourists from going there, but yeah, you're right. You know, if you ever do want to see paradise, it's a great place to be.
Yeah, I remember going in with the cruise ships, and we'd pass by Cuba, which was 90 miles the length of it. You know, before we moved past that, but it was great. Let's go to what we're dealing with: asset protection. What if in today's world, and it's a very confusing and a very scary world, James? How can we use the word protection and feel comfortable with it?
Well, the reason why the word protection is, you know, a lot of people think it's scary, and it's not really scary. What I try and teach and help people do is, and especially small businesses, is preventive protection. Protect your assets, meaning that, you put your stuff, you hide it away, essentially. So if something major happens, say, you know, you get a divorce or, you know, you have a medical emergency and you have to pay, you know, thousands of dollars in medical bills, that those creditors can't come after you and take all your hard work away because it's something that it wasn't your fault.
Yeah. Now, and by the way, in today's world, if you don't protect yourself and if you don't have, quote unquote, somebody looking over your shoulder and telling you how to do it, they will take it away. And I think that's critical. You know, people like yourself who, you know, you've been there, you've done that, you come back, and now you've got, you know, the methods to protect. And most people, that's not something that you're trained to do. The average person, the average small business has no idea how to protect an asset. It's in a realm that has nothing to do with the daily buy and sell.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You know, I see tons of small businesses, you know, every day that, you know, these people have a dream, they have a goal, and they always want to be self-employed and take control of their life. And, you know, they work very hard. They put, you know, 14 or even longer hour days in. And then all of a sudden, you know, something happens that maybe one of their employees makes a mistake or something happens that's beyond their control. Maybe the 2008, you know, financial recession where all the credit markets tightened up and all these small businesses couldn't finance their products to sell to their buyers. And now you see all these guys going broke. And it saddens me that these people have never, you know, never even thought about asset protection. And it's just, it's very simple. It's a very simple idea that, it's not too complicated. When you start getting into the offshore trusts and the grantor trusts, like our Eurotex Global Savings and Trust in Luxembourg, it gets a little bit more complicated. But everybody can really start up their own little asset protection scheme, so to speak, you know, within about an hour or two. All you have to do really, essentially, is if you're married and you have you're married and say you own the business, say Fred owns the business and Mary, we'll use them as an example. Mary is, you know, a stay-at-home mom. For instance, Fred would start a company and put the shares in Mary's name and all their cars, but maybe the vehicles in the house and a few other their valuable possessions would stay in her name. That way, if anything ever happens to Fred's business, creditors say his business goes broke and he signed personal guarantees, their house and their cars are going to be protected, and that way it gives them a good head start to start again, or, you know, gives them some protection from those vicious creditors. And it's not just about creditors in a bankruptcy case or something like that. It's also about, you know, there's people out there, especially in the United States, where it's a very litigious society, and you get a lot of medical malpractice suits, you get a lot of frivolous lawsuits. You know, people are always out there to take from you, and that's why the book is protecting yourself from professional takers. You know, it's like, for instance, if somebody breaks into your house and they break a leg, they have all right to sue you civilly, and you'd probably lose.
Sure. No question about it. And I think one of the things, by the way, are you talking about LLCs? Are you talking about trusts? What kind of a mechanism can you use to protect yourself?
You can use any, most states have a special program. And if they need to find out more information, because, you know, we're covering a broad range of markets here, I don't want to give any specifics just because I don't want to give any advice that's wrong or misleading to anybody. And they shouldn't contact a professional before they do anything serious. But it could be a company. It could be an LLC. The benefit to an LLC is, you know, the income is passed through. So, for instance, a lot of real estate is held in LLCs because somebody does get a judgment against it, they can only get a charging order against the profit. So a lot of real estate is protected that way. But, yeah, just a simple incorporation, an S-Corp or a C-Corp works well. You know, just if you want to hold cash, just, you know, you can go to Nevada, incorporate for $200 or $300.
Sure.
Take a day trip to Vegas, start up a bank account there, and bingo, you got asset protection, wire some money there, and then nobody knows you own it, and you have an element of a safety there, knowing that if somebody ever does garnish your wages or, you know, something happens there, you're going to always have that money.
Yeah, now, okay, now, by the way, that is in an account. You lost me somewhere. How do we go about, what's the tool to do it? And what we're saying is it'll be out of Vegas, right?
Well, you can do it at any state. Like I said, if you're just looking to protect, you know, $50,000 or $100,000, for instance, you know, I usually suggest to my clients, again, before any of your listeners do this, to seek professional advice. But what I usually tell my clients to do is go start up. You can go online, go to incorporateacompany.com. I don't know if that's a real website, but incorporate a company online. Get your articles of corporation, but make sure everything is separate, because when you own a company, an LLC, or another form of legal entity, it's like having another child. They're completely separate from your personal and other business affairs. So
okay,
you can
wait, let me hold you just for a second. Because what you're saying is so critically important, I want to make sure that the audience hears exactly what you're saying. So when you're saying, well, like an LLC, a prime example would be this. I own 7 pieces of real estate. Each one of those pieces of real estate, it's a business for itself. It has income, it has cash flow, et cetera. And I would incorporate a limited liability, an LLC corporation, on each one of those entities. So I have 7 different corporations. Somebody sues me for $10 million, and the property is only worth $2 million. Where are they going to get the other $8 million? Well, they can't go after anything else I've got if I've used the LLC. They can only go to the max that's allowable in that corporation. So effectively what we're dealing with is, when you say do it separately, each one stands alone, whereby if you get sued in any of those, they can't come after the rest of your assets somewhere else.
Correct, yeah. And how you usually take the money out is, like, it's a pass-through. So you get paid that way. But how a lot of guys will do is they'll have a management company. Like, for instance, a very famous, you know, real estate developer, you know his name, Donald Trump. He works with a management company, and all his projects, again, are owned by separate entities. And then his management company, the Trump Organization, gets a fee for managing those properties. And that's how he takes the profit out of those companies. So it's not a very complicated structure, but, you know, for the money that it costs, a lot of people are scared. You know, for $500 for a small businessman or woman, it's sometimes a little expensive, especially when they're starting out.
Sure.
But it's to pay $500 to start and do right is a lot better than paying $20,000 or $30,000 in legal bills in the future. Because if you get sued and your corporation has no assets, then guess what? You walk away, have a fun day, sue me.
Yeah. No, loud and clear. I completely understand it. It's like anything else. Most people aren't taught this. You're either going to learn it the hard way, or you're going to be smart enough to know somebody like yourself who has the information to be able to do it. But most people aren't. The word smart's not the right thing. They don't have the wherewithal, the where to pick up the phone, where to call to get what you need done. And there's so many, there's such confusion out there with these mixed messages constantly, day after day after day. It leads to something called apathy. You get so bombarded with it, you just kind of let things happen. That's when the trouble starts.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people get also confused, and they think asset protection is tax evasion. And no which way do we ever tell our clients, you know, to evade taxes. Everybody has to pay their fair share of taxes.
Sure.
And they have to be honest about it. Where people get into trouble with asset protection is, for instance, I'll give you an example. Say we're talking today, and I don't like something you said about me. I'm just using this as an example, and I sue you for libel. And all of a sudden, you know, now all of a sudden you're scared because maybe you made a mistake and said something wrong. Then what would happen is now you're running scared because maybe you know you've talked to your lawyer and he said, yeah, you're pretty liable for this stuff. Then what happens, you go transfer those assets out of your name to your wife's name at that time, and you don't really have a lot of money in the bank. So you say, okay, I'll do it for $1 or $10. So what happens is, yeah, those assets are transferred, but then all of a sudden, you know, I win a case against you, for instance, and say it's $1 million, and it's a lot of money for me to get from you. And I know those assets are probably going to be somewhere in your wife's name or somebody in your family's. So I do some investigating, and I find out, yes, you transfer those assets at a given date, through property registry, and now I go back, and it's called a clawback rule. So the number one key term that your listeners need to be aware of is called fair consideration. Whenever you're selling an asset to your wife, to your son, to your daughter, to a trust, to a LLC, to a whatever corporation, it always has to have fair consideration value, because there is a clawback rule. And if it goes in front of a judge is going to look at that and say, hey, you just transferred this $50,000 car to your wife for, you know, $1,000, you know, there's something fishy here. And then they have the right to claw back that transaction. And then you're liable to pay that money. And then they can even go seize that asset. So
okay, now what stops the judge from doing
that? That's one thing people need to be aware of.
Okay, but what stops it? What steps can we take to make sure that that doesn't happen?
To make sure, what, you don't get sued?
Well, at least they can't do a take back.
Okay, yeah, so the fair step, so say it's, well, you do preventive maintenance. So I call it preventive maintenance. So everybody should sit down at their table and they should say, okay, what assets do we have that we want to protect? They should make a list of assets. Now, I don't mean to protect your computer that's worth $200. It's not worth it because they devalue so much, nobody's going to want to take them anyways. I'm talking, you know, cars, real estate, you know, equities, securities like stocks and bonds and exchange traded funds. And also, you know, other valuables like jewelry, artwork, etc. Then what you need to do is you need to say, okay, what is the value of this property? Now what you do is you take that value of that property and you sell it to your LLC or whatever you choose, whatever legal structure you choose and best suits you. Now what happens is now there's going to be a taxable sequence there because you just sold something to another party and you may have made gains on it, okay? So now you either have to claim your tax that you've made gains, okay? Now that because you paid tax on that, because you've used the rule called fair consideration, if somebody does sue you, say, 6 months from now, and they say, well, you transferred your assets because you knew something was wrong, the judge is going to look at that and say, well, look, he sold this stuff for fair consideration. You know, he didn't do it to defraud his creditors because, you know, he used the money that he got from that sale to pay down his debt or to do something with it. So that's what I usually tell our clients to do. And I usually try and tell people to do it before they suspect any trouble. So if you're starting a new business or if you're embarking on a new real estate project, it's best to start the company now. I see so many of my real estate development friends, you know, they get excited and they buy a property underneath another property's name. And then they say, I'll just transfer it out later because the property's paid off. It's very easy to do. But then what happens, you create a sequence of events where now it's a traceable, there's a timeline there. So if somebody ever sues that corporation which owns real estate, they could come after that property they just purchased.
Okay, so effectively...
Does that make sense?
Somehow we're losing it back and forth. But James, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we just went off track for just a second. So picking the book up, going through the book itself, will it give me the steps to accomplish some of these goals?
It will give you a good understanding of how to accomplish these goals. It will give you some steps on how to go about doing asset protection. Asset protection is a serious thing, and under no circumstances would I ever give somebody, you know, a sketch on how to do it. because obviously every situation is different with every individual person. The best thing to do is contact like an asset protection professional, like a lawyer or a consultant like myself, to do that. But the book will give you a good understanding of what you may need. For instance, you know, real estate, we recommend LLCs. You know, for other forms of asset protection, we recommend just simple S corporations, or C corporations. In other circumstances, we recommend setting something offshore, which is better for the higher net worth clients because of there's certain advantages to doing that. So the book will give you good understanding. It'll allow you to be knowledgeable in the field of asset protection, and there are some steps on how to begin and start. But if somebody's looking to learn how to or to do it with the book, I wouldn't recommend that. I'd recommend contacting an asset protection professional just so you know what you're doing and you do it right.
Oh, no question. James, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at to buy the book.
Yeah, you can. If you would like to buy the book or speak to me, you can go to www.JamesTimothyWhite, J-A-M-E-S, Timothy, T-I-M-O-T-H-Y, White, W-H-I-T-E.com, or contact me at EuroTechFinance.com, and our corporate numbers on the page. You can just get a hold of me.
Wonderful. Hey, James, thank you so much for joining us. I think the information that you have is critical.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Shut up.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. We're going to have some fun right now. How an egg timer can help you quit procrastinating. I think that's one of the greatest things that anybody's ever said to anybody. Sarah Welch is with us. She's the author of Pretty Neat, The Buttoned Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection. What an interesting word. She's a woman on a mission to help busy people get imperfectly organized. And she has a co-author, Pretty Neat, The Buttoned Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection. She and her co-author, Sarah Welch, Alicia Rockmore, I'm sorry, they have a weekly syndicated newspaper column, having the leading organization blog and host an internet television show. And let us say, Sarah, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And thank you for being here. I get the two of you confused, but that will never happen again, I promise.
Oh, please. No worries at all. Alicia and I are interchangeable.
Okay, but you see, I was just showing you I was messy.
I would say a lot of people sort of panic when they think, oh, God, I'm talking to an organizational expert. I've got to be perfect, because organizational experts kind of get a bad rap for wanting to be perfect. And that's where we're really different. We are about embracing a little bit of imperfection so that you can get most of yourself, the big picture, buttoned up, because that's really what it's all about.
One of the things my mother taught me was basically to respect what I have. Now, respect what I have means to take care of it, to clean it up, to do certain things. So I've always been pretty neat and everything's been pretty well organized. Now, I've had people walk in and say, you know, you're a clean freak, which I'm not really. It's one of those I don't like, you know, I don't like disaster around the place. But most people just, it's the unorganized, it's just unintentional. I think that's really what it is. And then I'm not to that point if I walk through the room and I see a picture on the wall with a little bit off. That's not where I'm at all. But to wipe something up, to do something, to keep it organized, I really believe it's respecting it. And if you respect it, it respects you back.
Absolutely. It's a your mom did you well. She taught you a very important life lesson. And I bet your stuff lasts longer and you enjoy it more than somebody who's a little bit messier.
Yeah, it's called appreciation, that's all. And that doesn't mean that I would go crazy if somebody messed something up. I really don't care. You fix it after it's done. And I think that's really where it is. Now what caused the two of you to get involved in what you're getting into right now? Because I think organizational, quote unquote, has to do with lifestyle. It all falls into the auspices of doing the best with what you have and the most expedient way to do it.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting. I mean, we came at it in a roundabout sort of way. We were both toiling away in corporate America. We were starting to have families of our own and sort of looking at the corporate ladder and asking ourselves, do we want to be trying to climb that while having families? But then we also had a series of events in our own lives that really made us take stock of what does it mean to be organized in the first place. And so, for example, Alicia and I were together on 9/11, and we both live in New York, and so that's certainly something that provides a little bit of perspective. And then Alicia's sister, Alicia is 20 years younger than her next oldest sister, and her sister's husband walked out on her after 38 years of marriage, and she had been married at 21, raised four children, knew every detail about how to run a household and knew everyone's birthdays, those kinds of things, but she had no idea if her husband had a 401k plan or not. She didn't know what brokerage accounts they had or not, and then was in a position of having to try and recreate that or figure it out in a very hostile environment. And another thing was that Alicia's father was diagnosed with ALS and passed away very quickly. And her mom, you know, much older, has dementia. And in the year after her father passed away, they were finding, you know, a safe deposit box slip here, an insurance policy there, but they just didn't know what they didn't know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so these events sort of had us asking the question, what does it really mean to be organized? And, you know, as we looked around at all of the messages that we received about getting organized, it had to do with, you know, color coding your sock drawer, which kind of misses the point. So we, you know, we wanted to go out and really help busy people figure out how do you organize what's really important so that, you know, you can live a rich, full life and you know, forget about the, you know, color coding your sock drawer, which doesn't really matter.
Oh, by the way, when we talk about the things that happened to Alicia, and most people are like that, you know, there are women who they love being at home. They love raising kids. They don't have to be out in the corporate world. They don't have to do this. This is what they do. And then all of a sudden, the husband dies. And now we have to say, what is a checkbook? What are these pieces of paper within the, you know, within the cover? And it sounds funny, but it's not funny. It's true. When you haven't paid attention to something because you didn't have to, now all of a sudden the world looks a little different, and there's responsibilities that if you don't take on, you don't eat.
Well, and you know, it's getting back to procrastination to some extent. There are three main drivers of why we say, I'm going to get to XYZ, but it's number one, you dislike the task. So, you know, doing finances for a lot of people is not that much fun. Another big driver is a lack of confidence. So worrying that I don't know how, I'm not going to be good at it, I don't do math, you know, those kinds of things. And then if there's no real due date, so my husband's got it. He's totally taken care of it. There's no pressing need for me to figure it out. That is the trifecta when it comes to putting things off. If you have those three things, and often when it comes to organizing your important information and knowing about the basic financial underpinnings of a household, you know, we'll put it off, and we'll put it off because we don't like it, we don't have the confidence we can do it, and there's no pressing need for you to figure it out, at least it seems in the moment.
Now, by the way, and obviously procrastination is a big thing, because I would say 99 9/10% of everybody does it. I mean, they're just, it's almost inherent, and I love what you're talking
about. Human nature.
Sure, and I love about what you're talking about with the make yourself accountable. I remember years ago I would go into a gym, and if I would get so much out of it if I was there by myself. I enjoyed it, and I still do it. But if I had a workout partner, all of a sudden I was there at a certain time. I had responsibility. He and I were both accountable, and we did 10 times more than we normally would do. And I think teaming up with a friend, choosing incentives to keep you both on track, is probably one of the best things that someone can do, because now you're not alone.
Absolutely. I mean, we are the biggest fans of accountability buddies at getbuttonedup.com, and we write about it all the time. It's miraculous what having another person that you can be accountable to and for does in getting you over the procrastination, putting things off. Because as you said, you know, your word is out there, and you know, you're not gonna say, oh, I'll meet you at the gym at 6:30 tomorrow morning and then stand them up. That's not, you know, that's not acceptable for most people.
Especially if they're bigger than you are. You don't stand up.
Exactly. That wouldn't be good the next time you met them at the gym, for sure.
Oh, you know, and one of the other things, and I think it's extremely important, it sounds funny in its own way, not funny, but humorous in its own way, but it's so true. Making peace with the chores that you dislike by turning them into regular habits. There are people who hate doing certain things. I have three cats, and I got to tell you what, I am not happy at about 12 o'clock in the morning when I'm ready to crash that, I'd say four cats, but somebody might hear me. All right, I got four of them. At 1 o'clock in the morning, you can't just let it go. So it's a battle. Of course, I don't feed them for 4 or 5 days at a time, and it is the low. But that's
better.
The same.
Watch out, PETA's eavesdropping on this conversation.
Now I'm in trouble again.
You're absolutely right. You're talking about how do you make something a habit so that you don't have to think about it, because the minute you think about it, you're going to choose going to bed over dealing with the cats or cleaning out their litter box or whatever it is that you hate to do, but that you have to do. And if you can make it a habit, it becomes something that you don't really devote any brain space to or much brain space to, because it's something you can do on autopilot, often while you're multitasking doing something else. So it is one of the great cures for procrastination.
For me, it's cat stuff at night and making that pot of coffee before I go to bed. And it's just exactly like you said. Actually, it's become so habit that I don't even think about it. I just do it no matter what.
Yeah.
And because the alternative isn't too great, and it's not healthy for them. And so it gets done.
Well, interestingly, we've talked to a lot of researchers in and around this area, because habits do have the power to fundamentally make you organized in the bigger sense, and they're fantastic tools. It's the question is, how do you adopt a new habit and get it to stick? And generally, the research says you've got to stick to a habit as you're adopting it for around 20 to 30 days before you can really call it a habit. And there are two things that make you more likely to keep a habit up over that 20 to 30 day period and then stick with it over the long haul. And the first thing is, rather than focusing on something as I have to do it, having a mental shift to a moving towards goal or a positive goal. So rather than thinking about, you know, I have to get organized to do my finances, reframing that as, you know, an expression of freedom or of strength in some way, making it a positive thing that you're getting to do as opposed to, you know, a chore, if you will. And then
let me hold you up because I think that's critically important. When I clean the cats up at night, it's not I got to do this chore and I've got to do this. I'm concerned about their health. So it's a whole different thing. I'm not cleaning up cat stuff. That was a nice way to say it. I'm actually keeping them healthier and alive longer.
Yep, absolutely. And that's something that you want to do, right? Not something that you have to do. And that's a hugely important driver of behavior. And it's much more, you're much more likely to act when it's something that you deeply care about. So finding something that is a positive way to express this thing that you want to become habit is very powerful. And then the second thing is combining that with an if-then statement. So, you know, and a perfect example is me when I was trying to lose those gosh darn last 5 pounds of pregnancy weight, and, you know, it just takes a lot of willpower and better eating habits. And if-then statements work something like this. If I go out to eat, then I will order a salad. So you just kind of repeat a series of if-then statements around areas where you usually trip up. So trip-ups for me were going out to eat at restaurants or snacking habits in the late afternoon. And so I created some if-then statements like, if I have a snack craving in the late afternoon, then I'll pour myself a glass of sparkling water. If I go out to eat at a restaurant, then I'll order a salad. And you repeat those if-then statements to yourself, and then you'll find yourself kind of automatically doing those things when you're actually in the moment. It's pretty amazing how they work together.
I got it. At night, I'll say, if I climb through the back window instead of walking down the hallway, I won't get the guilt look when I pass by the cat box.
Well, I suppose, yes, that could work. But it may not bring you to that keeping your cat healthy goal that you're
I hear you. A little bit of levity never hurt, but you're absolutely correct. I think it's pre-planning, it is triggering it. One of the things that I will do and I have done for years and years and years and years, if I'm walking out of the room and I forgot to do something and I want to make sure I do it, I get this mental picture into my mind of when I go back into the room to pick it up, put it down, open it up, whatever the case may be. 9 out of 10 times when I walk back into the room, it'll trigger and I'll do it. And I think that's the same thing that you're really dealing with when you do the if I do this, if I do that. You're setting the pattern. You're setting the entire scenario up.
Yeah, and psychological researchers at NYU have done, you know, real studies around these techniques and have shown dramatic differences between people who use those kinds of techniques and people who don't. So, you know, if you are looking to get a more organized habit, that is certainly something that you want to try as you look to become more organized over time.
And by the way, habits are nothing more than repetition of action. If you do it enough, it becomes what we call, obviously, the habit. And anything that you do, if you do it over and over and over again, pretty soon it becomes so automatic that you don't even think about it. It just gets done. Because I think that that what you're doing when you're talking about organization, you know, anti-procrastinating, quote unquote, those are things that people really have a problem with. And why do they have a problem with? Because they're going at it accidentally as opposed to going at it intentionally. And if you go at it intentionally and you have an end goal, you know, at the end of the game, you know what you're doing, you specifically want to do that, then things work out. If you just get up and just let things happen, then there's a problem.
Michael, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I'm absolute 100% agree. And, you know, if you have an intention, your brain is sort of one step in front of your actions, and it makes you more likely to follow through. It just simply works. If you use it and practice it, you know, it will become a force to be reckoned with. I mean, we joke that Albert Einstein used to say compounding interest was the 8th wonder of the world, but I actually think daily little organizational habits, and I call them sort of the 5 minutes before you go to bed kind of habits, are actually an 8th wonder of the world as well, because those little 5-minute cleanups stack on top of each other and build your organizational muscle and, you know, carries through in a huge way in your day-to-day life.
Oh, sure. And one of the other things, too, that they talk about getting, you know, motivating the kids, getting them off the couch to help you, that it does something else with the kids. Because if you're doing it the right way, you end up connecting and bonding with those kids. You are doing something together. And most parents today have a problem in doing something together with the kids. Even if it's cleaning the floor, whatever the case may be, you're all in it, and it's a collective effort.
Yeah, one of the things that we talk a lot about at GetButtonedUp.com and also in our book Pretty Neat is this issue of delegating to family members. Because interestingly, organization is one of those things that, like it or not, is still largely in the woman's domain. I mean, we surveyed thousands of women and found that, you know, working women, whether they're working part-time or full-time, felt basically 100% responsible for the basics of keeping a household organized and running. And that asking for help, delegating to kids or spouses, was a very difficult thing for them. And so, you know, we devote an entire chapter in our book, Pretty Neat, specifically to how do you get up the courage to ask for help and enlist the help of your children. And part of it is also understanding that this trifecta of procrastinating, you know, how do you get them to look at a task favorably instead of as something they have to do? How do you give them the confidence that they can do it and encourage them along the way? I mean, a big mistake women make is they nag, and that, like, it's like fingers on a chalkboard to kids and to spouses in terms of, you know, making them not want to keep helping you. And then finally, giving them an exact due date of when it's due and when you expect it to be done and when you'll measure it. So
it sounds like something they have to learn when they get out into the job market. Sarah, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you in the book at?
You can find us at getbuttonedup.com, and you can find the book on our site or on amazon.com. Just look up Pretty Neat, The Buttoned Up Way to Get Organized and Let Go of Perfection.
Hey, Sarah Welch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
Take care. Good night.
I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Someday. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Phil Force is with us, Philip C. Force. He's the author of Letters from Limbo. That's his experience with a brain tumor and his perspective since. Phil, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Phil, when we talk about brain tumor, there's a tremendous amount of people out there with it, or they're getting the symptoms and they don't realize the symptoms are there until it's too late. So let's go back with you and your life right around the time that you were diagnosed. What was life like?
Well, let's see. My parents had just divorced. I was helping my father move to Arizona. And I spent pretty much the entire time I was in Arizona with my dad, either throwing up in the toilet or sitting on the toilet and throwing up in the bathtub next to me. So I finally went back home. I started to feel a little bit better after I got back home. I had lunch with my mom. And sitting at the table across from her at this Mexican restaurant, half of my body went numb. Mm-hmm. And mom said, you know what, that's it. We need to go to the doctor. An MRI later, they said, Phil, you have a brain tumor.
Now, by the way, when they said that's what it was, what was your experience of that? And I don't mean as the media says, how did you feel? That's not where I'm at. What was your experience of that? At that moment, life had to be a particular way. And all of a sudden, you get information that changes life drastically, like in a millisecond. When you found out what it was, what was the experience?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was pretty bored with life. I was almost complacent, if that's a good word for it.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy with what I was doing. I really didn't know where I was supposed to be going. And then just this roller coaster just peaked, and I said, oh, wow. And I started just going downhill immediately. And I almost shouted, yes, just excited. Finally, some different, something interesting.
No, and by the way, I can hear that loud and clear. There are too many people who go through life. Phil, they're upright. They're dead. They're doing what they're doing. They're doing the mechanics. But that doesn't mean anything. There's no fulfillment. There's no anything. Mm-hmm. And something as drastic as what they've said to you, all of a sudden now it's something completely different. Now, life with it, what happened then? Where did your perspective go? What is it that you saw differently once you started moving through the process of them fixing it?
Well, a big change was my idea of spirituality and God. I mean, I'd never been a person to pray before that, or I had been, but years had passed since I'd actually prayed. I was raised in a Christian home, and I kind of lost my spirituality during the whole rebellion, but immediately I said, you know what, I'm not in control. I can't understand why I ever thought I was in control. God, if you still remember me, Phil Force, I need your help. And so I just kind of gave in, and I wasn't sad. I was a little anxious, but I wasn't really upset. I said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And I just gave all my cares up to who I acknowledge as the higher power.
You know, a very interesting thing, when years and years ago I had a debilitating disease, and it was one of those things where they told me I'd have to have an operation, and I had probably a year and a half to live. Now, that's 13 years ago. Mm. And I remember almost the same similar situation. I knew I had to have an operation, and I knew that if I got in the best physical condition I possibly could, it would be easier for them to operate. So I'm running the hills, and I'm doing all my stuff, Phil. And I was in the garage, and I'm on an exercise cycle, a stationary bike, and I'm sweating, and all of a sudden it hit me. I made it okay to die. That didn't mean I wanted to die, but it made it okay to die. The minute made it okay to die, the stress went, and I think it allowed my immune system to kick in and do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And I think that's the magic for so many people. If they just, it doesn't mean you give in, but it's, if that's what it's going to be, that's what it's going to be, and allows your body to do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not stressed out about it, stress puts a lot of stress on the physical body as well. And if you can relieve that stress from your physical body, your body can do better healing you.
No, absolutely. Now, so you had that experience of it. What were people's response to you? You know, you're supposed to be frightened, but obviously you weren't frightened. What was their response to you? What was the support like?
It was really neat to have the family all together for me. I mean, I had friends and family in the hospital with me, and they were all there, and they were all worried for me, and I was just sitting there smiling the whole time. I actually, the night before I was supposed to have the operation, I had a few girlfriends in the hospital room with me, and we were watching TV and flipping through the channels. And I remember a male nurse coming in to check on us, and he seemed really surprised to see my smile. But I just loved the attention. I was like, I've got these three beautiful girls next to me, and I'm just going to enjoy all the attention I can get. And I remember he asked if we found anything good to watch on TV, and I said, we found the Booby Channel. And I was talking about the channel that was used to teach new mothers how to breastfeed. But everyone's just response was really surprised. Why are you so happy? And it was a lot, you know, just because I kind of, not that I gave up, but I gave any cares up to any higher power, you know, and I just stopped trying to pretend like I had control.
Now, by the way, when you went back to your spirituality, your religion, did it look differently? Because, you know, there's a difference between religion and spirituality, and I think the biggest difference between the two is the wall. And I would use an analogy like the bureaucracy in government. You've got government, and then you've got that wall between the government and those people that are the constituents. And religion sometimes acts the same way. You've got that bureaucracy between the true spirituality in God and your own reaction or your response to whatever religion is. How did you see it once you began to get it back?
Right. I actually spend a large portion of the book just reviewing biblical scriptures and things I once believed and kind of interpreting them differently. I mean, I personally believe that there is a God, a higher power. I don't think we necessarily need to give him a label, though. I think when we give label and try to define, then that puts separation between us. And that's why I've got people blowing other people up right now. It's because we just disagree on technicalities of it.
I completely agree with you. How do you define the undefinable? And then when you have, you know, God hates, God's mad at, you know, and et cetera, that's a human trait. How can an omnipotent being get mad at me?
Right, right. And I mean, there are scripture that talks about God's hate, but it's the way I've learned to define it. It's out of his love for his children and not for hate for any one particular person.
Let me give you my, come onto this planet and you get dealt a hand of cards. Now you can play those cards any way that you want to play them. You want happiness? Yes. And I don't think God ever says no. You want happiness? Yes. You want poverty? Yes. You want sadness? Yes. You want wealth? Yes. Anything you want, but you have to go get it. And we have been trained to want certain things. We have been trained to be lonely. We have been trained to be rejected by people, et cetera, et cetera. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, anybody who hasn't had that experience in their life of life could be over with, let's look at what caused us to be who we are a little differently now, don't really realize that in the end result, you run around life proving yourself right about yourself, and you draw to you those people who are going to prove it, the jobs that will prove it, anything you can get in your hands to show you that you're not good enough. And once you cross that bridge, and let's say that, all of a sudden it looks differently, and you're proving something different to yourself that you do like yourself, and there's more to it, and that's who you draw to you. So I think that transition, when somebody gets a debilitating disease, if they hit it right, and they get that inkling of, let's call it understanding, life does change.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's theories about, you know, hitting bottom, and you have to hit bottom before you can start coming back up and start feeling better. And maybe the tumor was bottom for me. I don't know if it necessarily has to be some kind of life-threatening situation, but it was obviously life-altering.
Oh, sure. And by the way, best thing that ever happened to you.
Best thing that ever happened to me. Wow.
Think about it. No, the tumor. The tumor
Really was
the best thing that ever happened to you.
That's true. That's very, yes.
Yeah. It's an interesting way to look at it. We go through all these challenges, pain, et cetera, so on and so forth. But then there comes that time you have to look at it and say, what did I get out of it? Where was I hiding? Where was my identity? Where's my dignity? And then all of a sudden something happens and you begin to realize all those places you were looking for it weren't the right places.
You know, that's true. I mean, I was very angry before. I was just mad at the world for what we were doing to the earth and just a bunch of just teenage angst and just a bunch of crap just going in that direction. Sure. And when I finally realized I'm not in control any longer, it made it a lot easier. And I kind of just gave in and said, you know what? Life's pretty good. I'm kind of just happy to be here right now. And I mean, I deal with stressful situations at work every day, and I just kind of smile at it. I just say, you know what? It could be worse.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. And now who is Alan and the little girl who loved you?
Alan was, he was a friend of mine. I met him in third grade at Oak Hill Elementary School. And, he was my best friend. He actually claimed the title first, I think, but we spent so much time together. And we were each other's world for a while. I mean, we just spent so much time together. We grew up together. And then eventually he shot himself. He shot himself in the head a few years back. It's been a while now, actually. And when he shot himself, it was after a long separation when I really hadn't spoken with him.
Yeah.
And I was really angry with him because I knew he was toying with the idea of suicide, and I was just mad at him for being so selfish. And how dare he, you know, be selfish and want to take his life when it's going to affect everyone else and especially me. Sure. And then I realized after his death, I grew to love him so much more and just understand who he was for me at the time. I mean, he was my brother. He wasn't blood, but he even lived with my family for a while. I loved him very much. And then the little girl, of course, was his younger sister.
Yeah.
And I've got so much, or I've experienced so much guilt over the relationship with Alan and then his little sister. Cause I, I felt like I used her a lot. I mean, I ended up taking her virginity when we were very young, and she wasn't really a willing participant, but didn't say no either. So it just kind of happened.
Yeah. Yes.
And you know, I've learned to forgive myself for the mistakes I made and for those situations, because I realize now that I was behaving in a way that was justifiable to me. And I believe that everyone on earth today behaves in a way that's justifiable to them, but they were huge parts of my history.
Well, but sure, it's proving yourself right about yourself. And mm-hmm. I'm going to go all the way back to that. And it's, you know, time and place, where you are, what it is. And, you know, sometimes you go back and let's say if she went through any trauma about it, that somehow, some way, shape, or form, if she can look at it, if she can look through the experience, because I don't really believe that anybody is carries 100% responsibility. It's a reversible cause and effect. If she looks through the experience, there's something to gain there.
Yeah.
Totally something to gain. Now, was Alan more than just a friend? Was he a boyfriend?
Not for me, he wasn't. I mean, okay. I loved him very much, but what's the word I'm looking for? The platonic
friends.
Relationship, yeah.
Friends, all right.
Yeah.
No problem. Now,
although, of course, his mother did accuse us of being gay, and that was a whole other story of us. We were never gay. We did paint our nails because that was what the banger kids did at the time. We thought it looked cool, but we weren't actually lovers or intimate in any way like that. It was quite an interesting time, though.
Well, how's this? That's another book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the whole key to this thing, you know, you've got, you know, there's a chapter on your dad there, The Aftermath.
And yeah.
How was the relationship with your dad before and after the tumor?
Well, it was not great before the tumor. I mean, we didn't talk a lot, but I didn't really want to talk with him. After the tumor, I kind of started, you know, feeling like there was missed time and that we really should be talking. And our relationship got better shortly after the tumor for a little while. And actually, I mean, you know, I helped him move right before it, so we were becoming friends right before it, and then the tumor, and that brought him closer to me. And then eventually, he just, I think he felt like I wasn't doing anything to try to get better. And one day he called, and of course I was in bed asleep, and my brother came in, and I said, you know what, I'll call him when I get up. I'm asleep right now. Don't be rude and just leave me alone. I'll call him back. Because, you know, I thought my brother was being rude. And I got up and called him, and he said, you know what, Phil, when I say jump, you say how high. And so you're cut off. I'm cutting any monetary support from you, and that's it. Good luck. So, okay, Dad. I really didn't know what to say. I said, okay. And then he just hung up on me. I said, great. And we didn't talk for a while. Eventually, we got to talk again a little bit, and I moved out to Arizona to work for him.
By the way, I want to throw a word out here. Mm-hmm. I'm listening to you very closely, and I'm hearing a word, and the word I'm hearing is actually, it's control. And mm-hmm. if you think about it, if you go back over your life before the tumor, the unhappiness, the rest of it, and I read your bio. And it's control. You know, you're supposed to be like everybody else, but I'm not going to be like everybody else. I'm going to be me. And then when the culture tries to control you, you fight the culture. But it all starts with family. It all starts with what you're like growing up, the relationship with mom and dad, the experiences. And if you're not getting it at home, you're not going to get it outside either until something happens like, quote unquote, the symbolic tumor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I've had fears of growing up and becoming my father. And I mean, I love my father so much. I really think he's a good guy, in spite of the fact that we're once again not talking. And I moved two states away from home to be with him. He's not here anymore. He moved away again. Yeah. I love him very much in spite of our less than perfect history. But I've always been kind of afraid that I'm going to turn into this kind of slave to money, this consumer. That I see my father, he's constantly chasing after money, trying to get money to survive. And I feel bad because I feel like he was trying to mold me into being that person. I don't want to be that person.
Yeah, but by the way, the more you fight it, the more you mold yourself into it. You know, there's that point of you got to go neutral with it. You got to just let it go, quote unquote. But I think symbolically, you got to find out what it is, you know, what money really means. And most people don't do that. If you could define your life, if you could define the words that run your life, then all of a sudden you could see life. And I mentioned this on the air a couple of times, but I think one of the most important things that somebody can do is project yourself out 10, 15, 20 years from now at a dinner party that's honoring you and write down all the things that you'd like them to say. And once you've got it, once you really sit down and you've got it, man, you've got 20 years to become who you want to be.
Right on.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. And by the way, the tumor was probably, again, the greatest thing that could have possibly happened to you. And the stuff with your dad, you never clear it with those people personally. What you clear it with is yourself, because it's within you. He's got nothing to do with it. He's got no power. The power is inside of you, and it's the power you give away.
Maybe I'll change the name of my book, Greatest Thing That Ever Happened to Me.
Absolutely. My tumor, my friend. The punchline. But actually, it is. When you really think about it, look at the way you look at life. Look at what it guided you to, your own spirituality, your own way of looking at things differently. Are you going to end up getting challenged? You bet you are. And so am I, and so we all will. But at the same time, the big one that had been plaguing you, quote unquote, that was already there. Now you got a chance to dump it and go on and find another one to plague you like we always do. And that's what life is, one lesson after another.
Well,
yeah. Or something like that. What do I know? I just talk. Okay. Now, by the way, okay, I pick up the book. I read it page by page, cover to cover.
Wow.
What's my takeaway? Phil, what do I get? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I picked the book up?
My biggest thing through my experience of writing Letters from Limbo, it wasn't actually necessarily the story of the tumor. I mean, the tumor changed my perspective a lot, but it was the perspective I gained after it. And actually just writing, I experienced so much pain and just so much regret, like I said, about Alan and the little girl and just the experiences with my dad. And by the end of the book, I really love myself. I mean, for the first time in my life, I'm happy with who I am. I struggled with, you know, neurotic tendencies and just trying to be perfect constantly.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are so many fabulous, faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain.
Vincent Bugliosi with us. He's the author of Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. And just this on the front of the book. I wish I'd written this deeply moving anecdote to the false certainties, both religious and irreligious, that have divided our society into warring camps, yammering at each other about things that no one understands. Frank Schaefer wrote that, New York Times bestselling author of Crazy for God. Vince Bugliosi with us has been called the quintessential prosecutor. Alan Dershowitz says if you created a prosecutorial hall of fame, Vince would be in the entranceway. In his career at the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, he successfully prosecuted 105 out of 106 felony jury trials, including 21 murder convictions without a single loss. And his most famous trial was the Charles Manson case that became the basis of his classic thriller, Helter Skelter. And Vince Bugliosi, welcome back. I have not talked to you. What's been a couple of years, hasn't it?
Yeah, Michael, it's great to be back on the show. I always honored to be interviewed by you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Vince, I want to start this out with a story. I was probably about 35 years ago. I'm laying on the beach in Southern California. It's an absolutely gorgeous night, and there's probably a million stars up there, and I'm enjoying myself. I'm taking it all in. And then I got to thinking, what's beyond that? And then I got to thinking, Vince, well, there's got to be something beyond the beyond. It's got to stop somewhere. But then how can it stop? Which started to get me a little bit scared because it went beyond my linear mind. And then I got to thinking about God, the undefinable. When somebody starts to define the undefinable, Vince, I think that's where we get in trouble. And the divinity of God, the God question, I think at this stage, the window of opportunity for this book to be here couldn't be at any better time based on what's going on in this world.
Yeah, I'm actually more excited about this book than any other book, Michael, in my entire career. And I've had 7 New York Times bestsellers. 3 got up to number one. And the reason is not just that there's no more important subject than God, but this has been a 2,000-year-old conversation in which really nothing significant has been brought to the table for a great number of years. And believe it or not, if you've had a time to look at the book, you may not have had that time, but I do talk about some things in here which, if they're true, if they're accepted as true, literally shake the very foundations of Christianity. But about not knowing what's up there, that's, you know, that's the heart of agnosticism. We don't say that we know what's up there or we don't know. An agnostic says, I don't know. The theist says, I do know. The atheist said, the atheist says he's not up there. The theist says, we do believe in God. And the agnostic says, I really don't know. Perhaps a better definition of agnostic is one who feels that the existence vis-a-vis non-existence of God is unknowable. And, of course, if it's unknowable, then you don't know. I like to point out to people, Michael, that I've got someone kind of bright on my side. At least a lot of people think he's bright. And his name is Einstein. Einstein was an agnostic.
Oh, I knew him. I knew him.
I'm sorry?
I said I knew him.
Yeah. You knew Einstein. Yeah. Darwin, incidentally, or I should say, interestingly enough, was also an agnostic. I say interestingly enough, Michael, because most evolutionists turn out to be, not all of them, but most of them are atheists, and yet the founder of evolution, Darwin, very, very strongly was an agnostic. I believe that the question of whether or not there is a God, like you're saying, looking up into the heavens and wondering what's up there, I believe it's an impenetrable mystery beyond human comprehension. The way Einstein put it, he said, the problem is too vast for our limited minds. And that's why I feel that the most reasonable position to take on the eternal question of God's existence is that of agnosticism. I like Gertrude Stein's non-literary definition of agnosticism. She said, there ain't no answer, there ain't going to be any answer, there never has been an answer, that's the answer. I thought that was rather clever, but perceptive.
Sure.
And Clarence Darrow, the great criminal defense attorney of the 1930s, the way he put it, he says, I don't purport to know what ignorant men are sure of. You might find it interesting that many people who have read Divinity of Doubt, they thanked me for writing the book for the simple reason that they found out, they said, who they were. Some of them had thought they were atheists, some thought they were theists, and then they read the book and they find out that actually they were agnostics. And that's not a common term, agnostics. A lot of people confuse agnosticism with atheism, but there's a very distinct difference. And anyway, Vince, they felt that finding out who they were was of some value to them.
Vince, let me hold you up for a minute, because in my experience, and I'm not a theologist, but in my experience, from what I understand, an agnostic is somebody who believes in something but they don't know what they believe in. An atheist is somebody who says they don't believe in anything but themselves, which in and of itself is an oxymoron, because if you don't believe in anything, you don't believe in yourself either. So I really think when it comes down to
very
it,
good.
Yeah.
And may I plagiarize you on that, Michael? It's very good.
Absolutely.
I love it.
It's yours.
I really feel that some of the things I talk about in this book, as opposed to the religious train being so barren out there right now, literally could shake the very foundations of Christianity. If you'll give me a couple minutes, I'll go over some of the
Please.
Main things that I'm talking about. Do we have that time?
You bet. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's take free will. You hear people say all the time, God gives all of us free will. And if you challenge them on it, they say, well, it's in the Bible. But I found out, Michael, that contrary to popular belief, the Bible really does not say there's free will. In fact, it says the precise opposite, that there is no free will. And I don't have to tell you the enormous ramifications of that. How do you explain God's punishment of evildoers if what they did was preordained by God? Now, mind you, I'm not saying there's no free will. If someone were to ask me, I'd say, why are you asking me? You may just as well have asked my neighbor or the local grocer. I'm talking about the Bible here, not my personal views. Let me
Sure.
give you a couple very quick citations from the Bible just to give you an indication of what I'm talking about. Isaiah 63:17 says, Lord, why do you cause us some free will? Why do you cause us to stray from thy ways? Romans 11:32 goes so far as to say, quote, God consigns all men to disobedience. The Talmudic scholars have been struggling, not for years, Michael, but for centuries, on how to get around, since Judaism believes so strongly in free will, how do they get around Exodus 4:21, where God tells Moses, I'm going to harden the heart of the Pharaoh, cause him to be stubborn so he won't set the people free, referring to the Israelites who were living in Egypt, supposedly then justifying his infliction of the 10 plagues on the poor people of Israel to force the Pharaoh to capitulate. Going on to another point, it turns out that the immortality of the soul that we hear about all the time was a pure invention of Plato in the 4th century B.C. I traced it all the way back to Plato, and I can get into all that if we had the time as how I ended up tracing it back to Plato. But Plato came up with 4 foundationless presuppositions that the soul was immortal. He presupposed that there was a God. He presupposed that there was a soul. He presupposed that the soul was immortal because he presupposed that it was never born. This is in his dialogue, Phaedrus, Phaedrus. So basically it was naked speculation on his part. And this naked speculation was embraced by Judaism and then by Christianity, and particularly Christianity was almost forced to embrace it because without it, there's no life after death, and if there's no life after death, there's no heaven and hell. And I would ask the rhetorical question, Michael, how does Christianity even survive? How does it stay alive if it does not have heaven and hell? This is what it offers or threatens its followers with. One more point, and then we'll get on to any other question you want. But I'm giving you some of the startling things in the book in an otherwise pretty barren religious terrain out there. I found evidence, Michael, in the New Testament, which when read in conjunction with the Hebrew Bible, specifically Isaiah 7:14, that proves not just beyond a reasonable doubt, but beyond all doubt that Jesus was not born of a virgin. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that Jesus was not born of a virgin. Again, I'm talking about the Bible here.
Sure.
If Jesus was not born of a virgin, then obviously he was not the Son of God. If he's not the Son of God, then the Christian doctrine that God had his Son die on the cross for our sins goes out the window too, which in effect ravages much of Christianity. Now, I would wager that a great number of people listening to the show now would find what I just said extremely hard to believe, but the only problem, if we're going to talk about the Bible, is that it happens to be the truth. And that's why quite a few people reading Divinity of Doubt have said that no one who reads this book is ever again going to feel quite the same way about God and religion. I'm just as harsh on the atheists in the book. I'm taking them on. In fact, they're the ones that are taking me on the Internet. You know, I'm still in the 19th century, Michael, with a yellow pad and pencil. I don't have a computer, but people send me stuff, printouts from the computer. And the atheists are telling people not to read the book. I don't know what I'm talking about. And one of the reasons is the way I talk about it in the book. I find atheism to be an intellectually, using the word barren again, almost vapid philosophy whose current champions, I'm talking about people like Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins. If you look at what they say, Michael, these people cannot come up with a non sequitur that they don't like. It's just a string of non sequiturs, and I don't know whether or not there's a God, but if there isn't, I do not believe that atheistic dogma leads one rationally to that conclusion. And I'm going to be speaking to 2 atheistic groups within the coming month, and hopefully there'll be some atheist out there who will be able to give me something that's not a non sequitur, that's a persuasive argument for the non-existence of God, but so far I haven't seen that. Theism doesn't have much either for the existence of God, but they do have one pretty strong argument, which we can get into later. It's the argument of first cause. That's an argument for the existence of God, and it's pretty difficult argument to get around. I've been doing all the talking, Michael. Why don't you take over?
No, okay, by the way, let me give you my take on free will, and this is what I've come to a conclusion free will is after all the years I've been on this planet. In my heart, okay, the God that I know, not believe in, the God that I know, free will is this. You get born on this planet, you get dealt a hand of cards. Now, you get the option of playing it the way you want to play that hand of cards. And I believe in my heart of hearts, and this is the conclusion that I've come to, that God, whatever God is, never says no. You want pain? Yes. You want pleasure? Yes. You want money? Yes. You want poverty? Yes. You call it. You get it. That's called free will. And a presupposition is an assumption. And the problem with an assumption, it has an incontestable conclusion. So if you can't prove it wrong, then you take it on
Michael,
as fact.
I don't know if you're on a cell phone or not, but the reception is not clear at all. You're coming in and out. I'm hearing you in and out, but I'm not hearing you straight through.
Oh, okay. And if it's doing that again, yell at me, and then worst comes to worst, I've got it recorded on this side, which we'll send to you, that you'll hear it, and then we'll have you come back on, and we'll make sure that
I can hear you. I can hear you, but I'm just saying every now and then I miss a word because it's not clear, and it's a little faint. But go ahead. So you feel that God gives us a free hand, and he's not responsible for all we exercise it?
Yeah. No, by the way, it's called free will. It's called you're responsible for what you do in this life. Now, the other thing is when we talk about does God punish? Well, you've heard the comment, you know, God hates homosexuals and so on and so forth. How can a deity that is omnipotent have a human emotion? Hate is a human emotion.
Good point.
Yeah. And if you're dealing with that, then God doesn't stand above you. God stands eye level to you.
Yes. Let me address myself to your first point, because I know many Christians have said that God gives all of us free will, and he's not responsible for how we exercise it. The first point that I would make is that, as I indicated, the Bible says that there's no free will. I'm not saying that. I don't know whether or not there is free will, but the Bible says that there's no free will. But let's assume for the sake of argument that we do have free will. And Christianity's response is that he's not responsible for how we exercise it. My take on that, Michael, is that God cannot escape culpability quite that easy. And the reason I say that is this. Hitler and Stalin, let's say they have free will to do good or bad. They choose to do bad, so God is not responsible for what they did. But God is also omniscient, which means he's all-knowing. He knows everything in the past, present, and future. So he knew what they were going to do before they did it. Also, he's omnipotent, which means he's all-powerful, which means he had the power to prevent them from doing what they did, and he decided to let them do what they did. Now, when people come back and say, well, I know what you're saying, but he's still not responsible, I ask this question, and I will ask you and your audience the question. Let's assume there's parents, and they have a son, call him Eddie, 17 years of age, and Eddie is robbing, raping, and murdering people in his part of town. The police don't know about it, but the parents do, and they have the power to stop them. And I've asked some Christians, what would you think of these parents if they said, well, you know, Eddie's got free will, and we're not responsible for how he exercises it. So we're not gonna stop him or even make any effort to stop him. I think you'll have to agree, Michael, that you wouldn't think very highly of those parents if they had the ability to stop Eddie from committing robbery, rape, and murder. And then the follow-up question is, why are we giving God a break on this? And then their response to that is that, well, I'm comparing apples with oranges. How can I compare the parents with a transcendent figure? But my rebuttal to that is that in the eyes of the law, if this were a legal question, you'd say that this is a distinction without substance. What difference does it make if he's a transcendent figure or the parents? In both cases, he or they are permitting a terrible, terrible thing to happen, and they're not intervening. Also, I'm not sure that argument is even helpful to the person making it, because if he, in fact, is transcendent and he's all good, again, going back to the law, a fortiori, all the more so it would seem that he should intervene. I mean, no one is claiming that the parents are all good, but Christianity has this notion that God is all good, and if he's all good and he's all powerful, it's kind of hard to get around the issue, why does he permit these things to happen? There's all ways of looking at this, but I'm a little troubled by the argument, which was given to me a long time ago by a Monsignor when I went to a Catholic school and about 8 years old. It was something very, very similar. He was an 80-year-old fellow, maybe in his higher than 80. I don't know how old he was, but he was gray-haired. He was a gray-haired eminence, deep baritone voice, and he shuffled his feet when he walked. And we kind of feared him because we were young. And he'd come into the class maybe once every 2 weeks, and he'd lecture to us on God being all good, all powerful, and all knowing. And one day, I don't know how old I was, 8 or 9, who knows? I said, Monsignor, if God is all good and all powerful and all knowing, why does he put people on this earth who, I'm sure I didn't use the word whom at that point, who he already knows are going to end up in hell? And he said to me, well, that's a good question, but I have the answer. And he said, the answer is that when we come to a fork in the road in life where one path will lead to heaven and the other path to hell, that's our choice. We have free will, and God's not responsible for the choice we make. And then I said to him, but you said, Monsignor, that God is all-knowing, so he already knows what path we're going to take. So I still don't understand why he puts people on earth if he knows they're going to end up in hell. And he just kind of coughed nervously, and he said, well, it was nearing the end of the hour, and we'll take this up at a later time, a time that never came. But obviously, I don't know the answers to all this stuff, but I think that Christianity...
Vince, let me hold you up. I think what I would love to do, we're running out of time, which I don't want to do. Let me set it up where you come back, and we'll do double the time to make sure that we get everything out, because I think the issue in and of itself is extremely important. Two things. I think hell was created to keep people in line. I don't even believe that there is a hell. The other side of that is to really get to where we want to be, we have to define what good means. And when we have a common definition of good, I think we can all move in the same direction. The problem now is what somebody thinks is good, somebody else doesn't. If I can take my daughter out and cut her head off because she looked at a man and it's good, then that's a society and that is a way of life for certain people. But in my world, that's not good. So as long as we both don't have the definition of what good is, I think we're in trouble. Vince, do you have a website we can find you at? And then we'll get you back on, and I want to spend some time with this.
No, but you can call my publicist. I think your publicist or what have you has her number, and we can book it for a later time. And we'll have to get a better reception because I have heard you tonight, but it's been faint and it's been spotty. But I'd like to come back and talk about so many other things, you know, like prayer and First Cause and intelligent design. There are quite a few things, and I always appreciate your asking very perceptive, intelligent questions, which is not that common, believe it or not, out on the airwaves. And so I'd be happy to come back, Michael, if you have me.
Great. Well, Vince, what we'll do is I'll schedule it for an entire hour, and we will get into it, and we will move from there. And by the way, it's been too long, and I really appreciate the time you're spending with us, and we'll reschedule you in.
Thank you so much, Michael. Okay.
Take care. Good night, Vince.
Take care. Bye. Okay, bye.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtain's falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment.